Brian Green is a theoretical physicist, so he's pretty clear-eyed about the cosmos. It's cold, it's barren, there's no conscious design, no God. Life is a fleeting aberration on an otherwise lifeless cosmic timeline. Sheesh. And that's how he used to feel from time to time, at these moments where he was left with this sense of hollow dread, like, what's the point?
I've been thinking about that for decades. And as I began to focus more intently on it, I began to have these feelings of dread that was surprising to me, the depth and the power that it had. That realization that all life and all thought is simply this fleeting thing, it did fill me with this darkness, this sense of terror, this sense of, what is it all for if it all goes away? And I had this amazing moment, though, in a Starbucks of all places. I was just having my usual Earl Grey with soy milk, nothing out of the ordinary. And all of a sudden, that hollow dread, it just shifted into a kind of sense of calmness and a sense of connection to the wider cosmos. And as I began to reflect on it, I realized that what was going on almost physiologically inside of me was a shift in perspective away from grasping for meaning and purpose to be found in leaving a legacy, in having some kind of symbolic transcendence where you or your works or your family sort of carries on into the far future. And with this shift of perspective, it was not ignoring the future, but it was recognizing that that wasn't the right place to be looking for value and for purpose. Rather, you have to look here. If you recognize that in the fundamental equations of the universe, there is no meaning, when you fully take that in, you recognize that we humans are the place where value and purpose emerges. We come up with these concepts in order that we can have a better coherence and a better understanding of our lives within reality. So you can say that makes value and purpose artificial, but I like to think that it makes it noble, because we're not grasping at the outer world to give us any notion of meaning. Rather, we are the ones that come up with that version of meaning that matters to ourselves as individuals. Value is in what we do, in the capacities of the human spirit to create and to think and to explore. And that shift happened to me sitting there in the Starbucks, and I just sort of had a moment of, wow, this is a different way of engaging with these ideas, and it's one that feels gratifying and soothing as opposed to something that fills me with terror.
Got a grande latte here.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, Brian Green surveys the universe from the very beginning, as far as we can tell, to the very end, as far as we can imagine it. And there is an end, he says. It's a long, long time away, but eventually all of these forces at play in the cosmos will burn up and fizzle out. But before that, there's the Big Bang, there's evolution, there's the development of language, the creation of tools and stories and religions. So, as he puts it, he looks from here to eternity. Brian Green is a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. His new book is Until the End of Time. And for obvious reasons, we didn't ask him to travel to a studio to talk to us. He joined us from home by phone. You point out in the book that across all cultures and throughout all time, the time of humans on this planet anyway, we have put a value, a significance on permanence. Why is that, do you think?
I think it's in reaction to this singular realization that we are going to die. You know, I think, you know, there are many species on this planet who respond to death of other members of their species. You know, elephants have, there's, you know, interesting data of them mourning their dead, and other animals have their own rituals following the death of a member of their group, of their tribe. But I don't think elephants, I could be wrong, but I don't think elephants are walking around wondering about what their purpose is or how they should spend their lives or worrying about the finite nature of their own existence. They respond to death, for sure, but I don't think they take it in the same way that we humans do. The fact that we have this conscious awareness, the fact that we have language, allows us to hover above the timeline and really reflect on the past and think about the future and recognize that our own lives occupy a little tiny window on that grand expanse. And so in response to that realization, we value things that have a longer footprint. We value things that have perhaps even permanence associated with them or near permanence. So we grasp and we focus upon and we place a great deal of existential weight on things that will last. You know, we build the pyramids, build them out of, you know, stone in order that they last. We chisel our names, if we are sufficiently resourceful, into stone. We imagine truths being chiseled in stone if we want them to last, right? We try to have some legacy that will carry forward. And I think all of this is in reflection of that fact that we all know at one level or another that we are ourselves impermanent.
Would you talk about the moment when this kind of occurred to you? Because there's this story you tell in the book where you were in school writing a psychology paper, and you came across this book by a man named Oswald Spengler, who had this observation that seemed to sort of take you off guard, the idea that, here, I'll read it, man is the only being that knows death, what you were referring to there before. Did it strike you then that, oh, this is the motivation that made sense to you at that point?
It hit me like a ton of bricks. It really did. And it's interesting how I was a physics and math major in college, and I just took this psychology course. It seemed interesting and thought it would be fun. I didn't think it would be life-changing, and yet it really was, because it was a course on human motivation. And if you think about it, that's kind of the deepest questions that we humans face. Why do we do what we do? We've got a finite, limited amount of time, and why do we do what we do? And in response to an assignment, a final assignment in that course, which was to come up with your own theory of human motivation, we studied many theories in the class, and it was up to you to invent your own. And in thinking about that, I had an interesting conversation with an old math mentor of mine that focused upon the fact that no physical structures in the world last forever, but certainly mathematical truths, they seem to last forever. If you prove something mathematically, well, you know, it's just kind of true forever. And that was an interesting realization and a powerful one when that was articulated to me by this mentor of mine. But then, as you note, I was also doing independent reading for this assignment, and I came upon Oswald Spengler's book. And as a small footnote, you know, some of Spengler's ideas have been used in pretty dark ways and insidious ways. But let's put that to the side for a moment. I was this naive kid in college, and just reading about his ideas, and particularly the paragraph that you just read back, was a potent moment for me, because it finally hit me that so much of what we do is coming from this realization that we are impermanent, that we are going to die. And it has not only infused, say, thinking in mathematics, where you realize, well, if you prove a theorem, it is something that will be true forever. As Spengler pointed out, it has implications right across the board, you know, religion, philosophy. If you think them through clearly, the deepest questions that they are seeking to address are questions of how you live a life when you recognize that your life is finite. I mean, Camus, right? In Myth of Sisyphus, the only truly philosophical question is that of suicide,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, he said it as starkly and as powerfully as you could imagine. Is life worth living? You have a finite amount of that time. Do you continue on with it? And if you do, why do you carry on with it? And those are the questions that deeply matter. So yes, when I first read about these ideas, you know, look, you know, we're all naive in college, we're all open to new ideas and so forth, but these were the ideas that not only hit me at the time, they have stayed with me over the decades and certainly have informed the things that the way I frame the unfolding of the cosmos, you know, in this new book of mine.
For sure. So these themes stayed with you. It seems like this is about the question of time. Is that the overriding
yeah.
theme there?
It is, right? I mean, time, yeah. from the scientific standpoint, is that concept which allows the ideas that we're talking about to have meaning. You know, if you ask me what time is as a physicist, I can't really give you an answer. No yeah. physicist or really thinkers that I've encountered can. But certainly I can give you qualities of time. And one potent quality is that time is that part of the universe that allows for change to occur. And so our lives are all about change, going from moment to moment to moment. And time, whatever it is fundamentally, is that characteristic of the world that allows that kind of progression to occur. So it is all about time. And in the book, of course, I take up various levels of that story. There's cosmic time, mm-hmm. going from the Big Bang, you know, right to the very end of reality itself. And then there's human subjective time that fits within that grand cosmological unfolding. And there's a beautiful, I consider, sort of wondrous reflection of the finite nature of the life of the individual against the finite nature of the life of the cosmos,
yeah.
which comes from ideas that were developed in the 1800s, a field called thermodynamics, and the second law of thermodynamics, and ideas of entropy, which ultimately lead us to the conclusion that we're not the only things in the universe that are finite, because the universe itself has that quality embedded within its fundamental mathematical architecture as well.
Yeah. We'll get to that. I want to start at the beginning, though. Because you say the book is, you walk us through this timeline of the universe, and you write in the book that you get inquiries about your views on whether there's a creator to this universe almost as much as you do about questions about physics. So the Big Bang, it comes up a lot. Talk a little bit about the questions you get about the beginning. I have to say there is a... your conversation with Joe Rogan not so long ago was really great, and he did ask what seems like the obvious question and kind of a perfect question, not just how did the Big Bang happen, but what existed? What was there before there was yeah. a Big Bang?
Yeah, and it's a great question, and one that we physicists, if we're honest about it, recognize that we don't yet have the final answer to that question by any means. And the fact that we don't have a solid answer that we can all agree upon is part of the reason, I think, why people then turn to, well, could that be where God slips into the story?
Yeah.
Could that be where a creator is the missing part of the explanation? And if you would only include that within your description, then you'd have the full story. And then the problem with that way of thinking, at least from a standpoint of a physicist, it just replaces one enigma with another enigma, one question that we can't answer with another one, right? So you can say, well, what happened before the Big Bang? You can say, well, that was God, but then what is God? What happened before God? What created God? Was there a time before God? You know, you open a whole set of parallel questions where you sort of replace universe by God, and therefore it doesn't feel very satisfying. But, you know, from the science standpoint, it could be, just to give a couple of ideas that people float, it could be that there was simply no time before
yeah.
the Big Bang,
yeah.
right? It could simply be that time starts with the Big Bang. And the analogy, you know, I probably mentioned the Joe Rogan show, but it's one I think may go back to Stephen Hawking. You know, if you're standing at the North Pole and you say, well, I want to go further north. Someone says, well, you can't go further north than the North Pole. This is where north begins.
Yeah, that question doesn't make any sense there.
Doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can parse it as an English sentence. It's grammatical, what happened before the Big Bang, but it may not actually be meaningful. The other possibility is it could be that the Big Bang was an interesting event in a pre-existing reality. And there was a whole history, a whole prehistory that existed long before the Big Bang. And there are mathematical theories that have been developed that suggest that maybe there were other bangs, other Big Bangs, if you will, that created other expanding realms, other universes. And our universe would then just be sort of one of a large collection of expanding regions of space that we like to call the multiverse. We would be one of many universes, each created by its own Big Bang, and therefore the notion of what happened before, well, there was just more bangs that were happening before.
It's Brian Greene. He's director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics, and we're talking about his new book, Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
As a yoga teacher, Jesmyn Stanley is well aware that much of yoga culture in the U.S. can be a little tone deaf.
Trying to understand the difference between appreciation and appropriation helps me find my own footing.
This week on Preach, the author of Everybody Yoga, on how yoga became her spiritual practice and being brave enough to share your unfiltered self on Instagram. Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the theoretical physicist Brian Greene. We're talking about his latest book, where he takes readers on this journey through the story of the universe, the beginning, but also the end, the time when everything, even conscious thought, will cease to exist. It's called Until the End of Time. You say that there are two forces that are kind of the leading characters in this big story. The first is entropy. The other is evolution. And Brian, maybe say something about those forces broadly, and we'll get into the details in a moment. You call these forces well-matched partners in the process that turns out to be life.
Yes. So entropy is this notion, together with this second law of thermodynamics that I mentioned a moment ago, is this tendency of the universe to go from order toward disorder, for structures over time to wither and disintegrate, to fall apart. There's a mathematical version of that familiar progression that we all see in everyday life in the world around us. And so that is one of the guiding principles that allows us to organize how the universe changes over time, how it changes as we head ever farther into the future. The other force is evolution, which kind of acts in the opposite direction to entropy. Evolution is really good at having matter come together into ever more refined, ever more complex organizational structures that are ever better adapted to the environmental challenges that they face. So roughly speaking, evolution tends to build up structures. Entropy tends to cause them to disintegrate. And over the course of cosmic history, we can see the battle, if you will, between these two forces wage. And for a while, evolution is able to keep entropy at bay and build structures like you, like me, like stars and planets. But when you go to the very far future, ultimately entropy prevails and everything falls apart.
You also mentioned how entropy, which is, you know, increasing disorder, but it's also thought of having this lack of predictability. But you say there are these subtle qualities of entropy that have allowed life in these systems to develop in really interesting ways. Wanted to give you a chance to talk about that part of it, because this was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, over the familiar intuitive notion of entropy that the culture has latched onto is similar to my brief description, which is entropy means disorder, disarray, things fall apart, and all that's true. However, the more precise statement is that overall, the total amount of disorder, the total amount of entropy will need to go up over time. But that does not preclude little pockets of order forming here and there, so long as when these orderly arrangements happen to form, in the process of their formation, they give off enough heat or waste to the environment so that the disorder in the environment goes up by an amount that's greater than the amount of order that's formed in that little region. And I call this the entropic two-step.
Yeah.
Basically, order can go up over here so long as enough disorder goes up over there to balance it out. And reality is that without this entropic two-step, there wouldn't be stars or planets or people. I mean, think about us, right? What do we do as human beings? We eat and we breathe, right? And that takes in orderly structures from the environment. I happen to be vegan, so the orderly structures that I take in are plants and fruit and nuts. So I take them in and I breathe. That allows me to burn those ingredients to get energy. What do I do with that energy? I use it to keep my order high. I use it to keep entropy at bay. But in the process, the entropic two-step demands that I release heat and waste to the environment, which I do, and you do, and we all do all the time. And it's that entropy that we release to the environment that pays for the order that we maintain during our lives. So you and I and everybody else, we all dance the entropic two-step for as long as we are able to. At some point, we give up, and then entropy prevails, and we disintegrate as well.
So for us to survive, the environment has to absorb and carry away all the waste that entropy generates. But that raises a question that you get at in the book, and that is there a point where the universe just gets stuffed, so packed that it becomes unable to absorb all that waste and heat?
Yeah, exactly. And the answer to that question, you know, it's again, as in the book, I give all the qualifications and the nuance, but for a rough description, as far as we can tell, the answer to that question is yes.
Yeah.
It's very far into the future. It's not something that we need to worry about today, right? We've got other things, more immediate concerns that we focus on, and rightly so at the moment. But if we set our sights on the far future, roughly, you know, 10 to the 50 years into the future, that's far longer than the duration, even back to the Big Bang from today, then over those timescales, yes, the universe will be unable to absorb the heat, the waste that any living being, if it still exists, any thinking, cogitating being, if it still exists, would necessarily have to emit into its surroundings. And that has a curious implication, which basically is that no life or no mind will be able to persist arbitrarily far into the future. Because let's say there is a thinking being in the far future, and the very act of thought is a physical process which itself necessarily produces waste heat, right?
Yeah.
Your laptop is hot because in some sense it's thinking, it's computing, and in the process it necessarily generates heat to the environment. If I'm being more precise, when it erases its memory, it necessarily generates heat. And so in the far future, when any thinking being, any computing structure is trying to carry out its calculations, it will necessarily release heat to the environment, but the environment will say, no more. I can't absorb anymore.
Yeah.
And therefore, that structure will actually burn up in its own entropic waste and will disintegrate.
So at that point, life ceases to be able to exist. Thought ceases to be able to exist.
As far as we can tell, based upon our current understanding of the universe, absolutely right.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about evolution, then you write about evolution, of course. So about a billion years after the Earth forms, life's well underway, and the standard Darwinian evolution, you say, kicks in, and these random mutations start making the organism. And I wanted you to say something, if you would, because I thought it was sort of beautifully put in the book by you, this amazing complexity of this molecular arrangement. In the book, you explain what goes into just reaching for a cup of coffee, for example.
Yeah. It is utterly remarkable when you think about the fact that we humans and every other material structure that we see in the world around us is just a collection of nature's fundamental particles, the fundamental ingredients, coming together under the forces of nature into interesting, complex configurations. And so when you do anything at all, when you think, when you eat, when you move, and as you say, when you reach out your hand to grasp a cup of coffee, it is just a highly coordinated collection of molecular motions that are allowing those behaviors and those thoughts to take place. So at the level, the reductionist level, which is not the full story of reality, as I describe in the book, it's vital that you layer onto the reductionist story all the other accounts that come ever closer to the language that we would use in everyday experience to describe what it means to be a human being walking around on planet Earth. But way down at that reductionist story, undergirding every other description, is just the motion of particles governed by mathematical law. And to me, it's utterly wondrous that particles, the same kind of particles that make up the coffee cup, the same kind of particles that make up your desk, the same kind of particles are arranged in a somewhat more complex and refined manner inside your body and inside your brain. And because of that organization, your particles are able to think and wonder and reflect and take interesting actions and create interesting structures, but it's all coming from particles governed by mathematical law.
I wanted to ask about consciousness. This is such a critical – in fact, there's this question that's always there, it seems like, through the book. In fact, you say it generally goes with us on this journey, and it's whether conscious thought can persist – indefinitely, or could it go extinct? I guess we were talking about that before. Explain that question, if you would,
sure.
Because you say in the book you're wondering whether the phenomenon of thought will persist into the future. Does that get at what you were saying earlier?
Well, it is. The key background, which we can now talk about, is it the case that consciousness is accurately described in the language that I've used? Is it the case that consciousness is nothing but the motion of particles inside this 3-pound gloppy gray structure that exists sitting on top of our shoulders, our brains?
Yeah.
Or, as some have suggested, is consciousness something more than that? Some have suggested that maybe there's a consciousness field that sort of immersed all around us, and our brains kind of tap into it in some way. You know, others have suggested that maybe even the very particles that make up the brain and all other matter, maybe they are themselves endowed with a certain little bit of consciousness, proto-consciousness, and only because of their proto-conscious qualities, when you group them all together, do you get a thinking being such as we humans. So there are many, many ideas out there on the table as to where consciousness comes from. But my view, which I'm happy to describe the journey that has taken me to this perspective, but my view is the one I was saying before.
Yeah.
Consciousness is nothing but the motion of particles in a highly organized structure, and consciousness is kind of the byproduct or the natural consequence of the particles moving in the right way, coursing through the right complex structure. And if that is correct, if consciousness is nothing but material particles moving according to physical law inside an organized structure, and if, as we were saying, you can show that in the very far future, the behaviors, the motions of those particles will not be able to persist because they would generate heat and waste that the environment will be unable to absorb, then that comes to this conclusion that conscious thought is itself a finite process. It emerged at some point in the development of the cosmos when evolution was able to create a sufficiently complex, refined structure such as us human beings, but in the far future it will be gone. So in the long stretch of time in the past, there was no consciousness, and for a very long stretch of time in the far future, there likely will not be consciousness either.
Do we – I can't imagine it would be possible to pinpoint even a frame of time when there became self-awareness, there became conscious thought with a brain.
Well, I think you're right in that you can't pinpoint a moment, and I think that's because Consciousness, I don't think, is a digital phenomenon. I don't think it's a yes or no, conscious or not conscious. I think there's a continuum, and the continuum really stretches. You know, we humans are, we like to think, at least at one end of that continuum. And as you sweep back through other species, you encounter various versions of conscious self-awareness, and as you go ever further back, there's ever less evidence that that conscious self-awareness aligns with our experience. So the further off you go along that continuum, the farther afield you go from the conscious self-awareness that we experience in our daily lives. But I don't think there's a place where there's a sharp break,
yeah,
where you say, aha, this is where consciousness began, or this is where consciousness ends, depending on which direction on the continuum you're walking. It really is something that just gradually emerges and gradually disappears, depending on the direction you're considering it.
Let's talk about language. And I wanted to begin in this section, as you do in the book, with this question, which is really interesting, about whether mathematics is a language that we developed to figure out the patterns that we encountered as humans, or if it's, as you were referring to earlier, you know, your mentor, that it's a source of reality, it's a fact, it's a truth. Take me through that, if you would.
Well, it's a deep question that physicists and mathematicians and thinkers have debated for a very, very long time. You know, is math out there and we just discover theorems and we discover the utility of certain equations for describing things that we observe in the world, or is math invented by the human mind in order that it can have a better grasp on the things that it experiences? And again, in the service of giving you my own perspective, my view on this issue has changed a number of times during the course of my professional career. In the early days, I was pretty convinced that when we did physics and we used math, we were really revealing qualities of the world that were out there. And as I've gotten older and thought about things, I like to think more deeply, I've shifted to the other perspective, that we invent this framework called mathematics because it's really good at encapsulating pattern. And pattern is the tool by which we gain an understanding of happenings in the world. If the world didn't have patterns, if it wasn't for the fact that when you drop something, it always falls, if it wasn't for the fact that the sun always rises, if it wasn't for the fact that, you know, water, when you heat it, it boils and evaporates, it always does, right? If it wasn't for these patterns, I don't see how science would have made any headway at all. What would we have been doing? We would have been doing taxonomy. We would have just written down the things that we see in the world, but they would have been incoherent facts that we couldn't organize into a nice systematic collection of ideas that we could articulate in this language of mathematics. So my perspective right now is that math is a language. English is a language, French is a language, and math is a language that we humans invent. It's a language that's particularly suited to one purpose, which is articulating patterns that we either see in the world or we invent and study in our minds. And for that reason, it's really a good language for articulating the laws of physics, which are all about the patterns that take place in the reality that we experience.
Well, you do mention in the book and a few times that there are others who argue that we need to come up with new perspectives about the nature of, you know, not just the mind, but the nature of reality, so we can better understand consciousness or language, all of those
yes.
kinds of things.
Well, I think consciousness is the one place where an argument, at least in this era, can be made that maybe it's not all mathematics. Somebody can simply say, I don't buy it.
Yeah.
I'm with Descartes. I don't buy that consciousness could ever simply emerge from the motion of particles and whatever organized structure they may be housed within. And there's no argument today that can say, here's why you are wrong. All we can do is point toward trends and discoveries that suggest that perspective is wrong. And what I like to point to is the fact that in the 1800s, people made similar remarks about life. People said, hey, how can particles that are not alive themselves come together in complex structures that are alive? And the answer that some suggested was they cannot. You have to inject something into the group of particles, a life force, vitalism. You have to give it something else, and only then does the collection of particles light up with the sparks of life. But now nobody says that, right?
Yeah.
150 years later, advances in biology and science more generally, scientists have pretty much come to the consensus that particles and laws of physics and chemistry, you put things together in the right way, and life can simply emerge from that collection. You don't need anything else, no life force. You don't need this sort of vitalism to be part of the story. And I think the same is true of consciousness, even though we're not there yet. I believe we'll get to a point where we'll say it's just particles and laws of physics, put them things together in the right way, and it will have an inner world of conscious experience.
Is there anything kind of sad about that, that we will – because you do say in the book that you believe one day scientists will be able to provide this complete, mathematically complete articulation of all of the processes underlying anything that happens. If you're a scientist, of course, that's great. That's fantastic. But then it does strip away the question and the mystery. How are you thinking about that tension, I guess?
Well, I think the operative word there was mystery.
Yeah.
And many people have a sense that mystery is essential to depth of experience. And I get that. I like mystery. I spend my life trying to figure out mysteries, right? So I totally get where people are coming from on that. But I think Richard Feynman, you know, great physicist who passed some decades ago, said it really, I've never heard it said better. He said, look, he says, when I look at a red rose, I experience it at a human level like everybody else. I experience the rich red color. I can breathe in the sweet aroma, and I can feel all of that. He said, but because I understand physics, I can also go deeper. He says, I can see the molecules and atoms responsible for emitting that red color. I can understand the chemical processes that yield the aroma. He says, those reductionist stories don't diminish from my human experience. They add to it. So it's a wonder that's not based on ignorance. It's a wonder based on insight. And I really do feel that the wonder based on insight can reach an even deeper level than the one that's based on ignorance and mystery, if you allow yourself to fully take in the ideas. So do I think it strips it away? If one day we can give a full account of why we humans, you know, respond to the Mona Lisa or hear Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and it moves us in a deep and compelling way, if we can explain all that right down at the level of molecules and atoms, I do not think that it will flatten or remove the human experience. Instead, I think it will give it a depth and a richness and a recognition of, wow, move particles in that way and a human being can be brought to tears. And I think that that can actually be a poetic addition to the raw human experience.
Brian Green, why do we tell stories? Or why, as you ask in the book, why would we set aside hunting and gathering to spend time telling stories about the gods or imagining other worlds? Why does that make sense in an evolutionary, selective way?
Well, from an evolutionary perspective, people put forward, you know, interesting potential answers to that question. And the one that resonates most with me is that storytelling is a means of exploring reality, exploring human interactions, exploring human experience in a completely safe way that allows us to refine our responses to challenges that we will encounter one day in the real world. You know, ethologists have long known that animals often engage in ritual play, and some of this play can be really rough and tumble and harsh, and the recognition is that animals are rehearsing for the battles that they may actually have to engage in the real world. But if they can do it in a fun way and in a safe way by rough play, this refines their reactions when the real thing happens in the real world. So some people have called this sort of the flight simulator view of storytelling. Why do we tell stories? We tell them because it's as if there's this flight simulator. We're not actually, you know, a pilot behind, you know, a wheel on an airplane, but we are a pilot behind the wheel of a story describing some kind of engagement with the world. You know, it could be a social engagement. It could be, how do I keep, you know, so-and-so from taking my food? How do I keep so-and-so from you know, invading my family and stealing my partner? You know, things of that sort. And we can simulate these human encounters through fictional storytelling, and in that way refine the kinds of responses that we will actually come up with if and when we encounter similar experiences in our actual lives.
You mentioned also myth, that myth sort of fits into this idea that we would rather hear terrifying stories of fantasy than terrifying stories of reality. And maybe that's why we invented monsters rather than the real monsters that existed that were trying to prey on us, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, myth is a certain kind of story. It's a very larger-than-life story. It's a story in which we are imagining things well beyond anything that we've encountered in the real world. And again, it raises this question mark, you know, why those kinds of stories? I mean, you can perhaps give the flight simulator explanation if you're talking about a story that involves real people in a real setting that a person might actually encounter in their own lives. But few of us are ever going to encounter monsters or gods or demigods or things of that sort. But again, it fits into the same progression because we prevailed. Because not only are we a deeply social species, but our brains allow us to imagine things that we have never yet encountered. And it's that means by which we are hugely innovative, by which we have great ingenuity in solving real-world problems. Our brains scour a whole range of possibility well beyond things that are actually real, and within that extraordinary breadth of imagination, on occasion, we come up with ideas that really do matter to our lives in a real way. So myth is, in some sense, taking the phenomenon of story, blending it with the power of human imagination to create these larger-than-life escapades that really allow us to exercise ingenuity and innovation and allow our imaginative juices to flow.
Where does religion fit in that idea?
Well, religion, again, is sort of a natural consequence of this kind of progression, married to the idea that we were discussing earlier, the recognition that we're all finite, that we will all die. I think Stephen Jay Gould said it really well, that all religions, in some way or another, begin with the recognition of mortality, the recognition of death. And different religions cope with this issue in different ways. Some suggest that, sure, your body may die, but there's an eternal soul inside of you that will carry on. That's a spectacularly clever idea, and I don't mean to denigrate in any way religious tradition by saying that, but it is a marvelous response to this recognition that could otherwise be debilitating. If you think that it all ends when you die versus you have this transcendence, that the thing that really matters to you, which is your personality and your inner conscious awareness, if that's going to carry on, that can be a palliative. That is deeply powerful to keep us from the otherwise debilitating realization of our own mortal nature. Other religions have different approaches. Some, of course, deal with cycles of birth and rebirth. And in that way, we're able to see the cycles of life as only one among a grand collection of cycles. So we don't feel that death is the end. Rather, death is simply the end of the cycle and the beginning of the next. So from an evolutionary perspective, that's one potential role of religion. Others have suggested that religion is a powerful social glue, that if you and I are related to each other, it makes sense that we'll protect each other because we share the same genetic profile, or at least a large part of it. So if I protect a sibling, then if that sibling reproduces, it's actually my genes, you know, in some way, half of my genes, that are going to, you know, have a chance of propagating, whereas otherwise they would not have that chance. But if you and I are not related, how do we bind together in groups that can prevail against other groups in battles that may have taken place in our hunter-gatherer past? one answer. If you and I both believe in the same God, if you and I both adhere to the same religious practice, then that binds us in a way that is perhaps as strong or stronger than us being bound by a common genetic basis. So that may be another reason why religion prevailed, because those groups that had a strong religious commitment are the ones that won in the battles of the ancestral world and thereby passed on the genetic predilection to have religious affiliation.
We were talking earlier about where this journey ends in the book, and that is sort of the idea where planets and stars and thought itself becomes physically impossible. And I wanted to read something from the beginning of the book. You say, in a universe that will ultimately be devoid of life and consciousness, where does that leave us? So how are you thinking about those of us who cope with the tension of those realities? Because you get at that at the end of the book.
I do. And my view is that these scientific insights can really reframe your perspective on what it's all about. You know, when I think about the fact that we are just collections of particles governed by the mindless, purposeless, meaningless laws of physics, that gives me the following view of how we came to be, right? We are the product of a long collection of quantum processes that stretch all the way back to the Big Bang. And each of those processes could have turned out differently. It could have turned out that way instead of this way, yielding a universe in which we would not be here, which means, against utterly astounding odds, our collections of particles somehow coalesced to yield the life forms that we call humans, to yield you and to yield me. And that is wondrous. And it's not only wondrous simply against odds, it's wondrous what our organized collection of particles can do, right? I mean, we can create beauty, right? We can illuminate mystery. We can experience wonder. We can create things, right? From the cave paintings at Lascaux to the Egyptian pyramids to Macbeth, Shakespeare writing King Lear to the final minute of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I mean, look at the things that a collection of particles can create. And in the end, this just fills me with gratitude for being here at all. It's gratitude for existence. It's gratitude for these blind forces that coalesced to allow, for a brief moment in cosmic history, collections of particles like us to exist and to think and feel and to wonder and experience it all. And to me, that is itself something that is deeply stirring and deeply meaningful, and I don't need it to last forever. I'm just grateful for it existing at all.
Maybe that's where we come down on a very strange week. I mean, I confess to feeling some sense of something apocalyptic going on after this week. I mean, we had a decent-sized earthquake here in Salt Lake City, and most of us felt it from our homes where, of course, we're isolated because of this global viral pandemic. But you mentioned how the entire duration of human activity is just fleeting, and we should just treat it as a moment that's rare and have it give us a sense of gratitude, I guess.
Yes. Now, look, this is a challenging time to hold that perspective in mind. It's challenging for me. I've got two kids, you know, 12 and 15, who are old enough to really worry about what is going on. And I just try to continue to give them the recognition that we as a human species have triumphed over a tremendous number of challenges in the past. And I feel strongly that we will triumph over this particular challenge. It doesn't mean we can be complacent. We need to play our part in ensuring that we do prevail, that we do survive. But I strongly feel that, you know, 20, 50, 100 years from now, people will look back at this era the way we look back, say, at the pandemic of 1918 or the Depression of 1929, as a challenging moment in human history where we humans as a collective came through. It doesn't mean that we're not going to experience tragedy. It's not going to mean that some of us are not going to experience devastation. But collectively, we will survive, we will prevail, and ultimately, it is a beautiful fact that we are able to rise to such challenges at all.
Brian Greene, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Brian Greene, he's a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. His new book is Until the End of Time: Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, L.A. Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.